Okay, Erev Tov, everybody, and Boker Tov for those in Israel. Pleasure to welcome everybody to the, I guess, the last of our 5781 Parshat HaShavua Shirim. So, Achron, Achron, Chaviv. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Gemara, Rav Shlomo Gemara, who was, I guess I have to be very careful. He's one of my bosses at Tenenbaum Chad, where he serves as the vice principal and, where I teach. And, Rabbi Gemara, has been in Toronto already since, 1993. He served for, I believe, 18 years as the Rosh Yeshiva of the Bnei Akiva schools. He's a wonderful, wonderful mechanech who has a great love of his students. And as he even put in his bio, he got into teaching because he was a grade 9 student during the Yom Kippur War. And they didn't have enough teachers, unfortunately. Everybody was up on the front. So he substituted, so to speak, and teaching young kids. And that was his introduction into chinuch. And it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Gemara to make his Zoom debut on Torah Motion. Bakasha, Rabbi Gemara.
Thank you very, very much. It's really a great pleasure for me. And, you know, I have to acknowledge the humongous contribution of Torah in Motion to the Torah life in this city. As an educator, I know the challenge of bringing intelligent voice into our ancient sources. And I think that what happened in Torah in Motion is a prime example of how we can be united around the Torah. You know, I'm sure that all the people, even right now, might be different in their background and practice, but you know, the Torah deserves to deal with honestly and accurately. And I'm always inspired by the speakers that Rabbi Kelman brings, and I feel it is a great honor for me to be now part of them. So thank you very much. And as you said, the Gemara said that the Golel, the one who folds the Sefer Torah at the end, he gets the reward for everyone. So thank you very much for having me as the last guest for Tafshin Pei Aleph. I feel like the Golel of the Sefer Torah. So thank you very, very much. And hopefully next year I'll have another opportunity to speak with this esteemed group. So this parsha is the parsha of Nitzavim. And first of all, I want to say something very important. I will follow now the opinion of the Abarbanel. We all know that last week in the parsha of Kitavo, we had one of the worst parashot in the Torah, so to speak, the parsha of the Tochecha, that the custom in our shuls is to read it very quietly in order to avoid the harshness of all the curses in the Torah. In Parashat Nitzavim, you would expect, you know, a little bit relief. But the interesting thing is that Parashat Nitzavim also start with a new set of rebuke. Just the word of Gofrit v'melach srefa kol arza, like sulfur and salt have burned up its entire land. Again, we have a new set of curses that it drew the attention of the Mefarshim. What happened here? You already stopped it in the last parsha. Why do you start it all over again? I will follow this time the opinion of the Abarbanel and maybe a few more who see it as a completely new parsha. According to them, Parashat Nitzavim was the last speech of Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, the Sefer Dvarim is divided to four speeches, major speeches of Moshe Rabbeinu in the month before he passed away. But this special parsha, the parsha of Nitzavim and Azinu, were delivered in the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is a completely new rebuke and a new a contract signed between Bnei Israel and Hashem on top of everything that was signed before. And actually, the final, I would say, ceremony of signing this contract of Parashat Nitzavim is going to happen a few weeks down the road when they are going to cross the Jordan and to come to Har Gerizim and Har Ebal. This will be like the official ceremony where they are going to sign this contract, the contract of this Brit that Moshe Rabbeinu delivered in his last day. You know, this parsha is a short one, and I would suggest everyone who can to open a Chama Leibovitch on this little parsha. She had, I think, 6 or 7 different shiurim. Each one is fantastic. I'm not going to repeat any of it here. I want actually to focus on some details that maybe from the details we come to the greater picture. One thing I want to share with you right from the beginning, if you have any question, please. Let me know, and if you need to see some of the sources or whatever it is, send me a quick message on chat. Hopefully, I will be able to see it and to respond right away. Okay, so let's see a few of the psukim in Parashat Nitzavim. Rabbi Kelman, Ivrit Anglit, how to read it?
No, read it in Ivrit, and then you can translate it in Anglit.
Okay, so I just
paraphrase in Anglit.
We have enough time.
It's a paraphrase in English.
Okay, so the Torah said, "In the later generation, your descendants who will rise after you, along with the foreigner who comes from a distant land, will say upon seeing the plagues of that land and the diseases with which the Lord struck it." So the Torah describes here a foreigner who comes to Eretz Israel and is struck by the plagues of this land. Gofrit v'melach sreifa kol arza, which obviously remind us what happened in Sodom v'Amorah. The Torah itself said, sulfur and salt have burned up its entire land. It cannot be sown, nor can it grow anything. Not even any grass will sprout upon it. It is like the overturning of Sodom and Gomorrah, Adama and Zeboim, which the Lord overturned in his fury and in his rage. You know, many nevuot, especially the tochechot, the rebukes, were fulfilled, as the Ramban said, to the letter. Am Israel, unfortunately, did not just hear about all these rebukes and all the curses. We suffered each one of them. The Ramban said, Achad lo neda, one is not absent, unfortunately. We don't need, if you want any proof to the Nevuah of Moshe, just take the klalot that unfortunately we suffered over the tragic Jewish history in the last few millennia. But there is something very interesting in this pasuk that really drew the attention of modern scholars. And this is the description of the Torah, that a person will come from Eretz Rechoka and he will be struck by the terrible destruction of the land. And you know what? It's really interesting that sometimes we can see it with our own eyes. The Nevuot of Hashem, Nevi'ei Ha'emet V'Hatzedek, and the Torah really meant, every word means something. And I want to share with you, who is this foreigner who came from Eretz Nochria, from a very remote land, that at the time of the Torah, by the way, no one knew even about this land. I'm talking about America. And I'm talking about someone that I'm sure you love to read these books as children. I loved it. And this is Tom Sawyer. I think his real name was Samuel Clemens or something like this. And interestingly enough, first of all, he got good education. I mean, Christian education, which means he knew Tanakh. I say many, many times, I wish our Jewish children who still bear the names of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, they will know Tanakh, as some of the previous generation, even non-Jews, knew the Tanakh. And I always like to tell the story that Truman himself said, that you remember that as a kid, his father, when he took him to the church, he always told him about the future redemption of the Jewish people and all the promises of Yeshayahu. And when it came to him to decide if America is going to say yes or no, to the establishment of Medinat Israel, somehow it resonated with him, and he knew, like from within, that America, the United States, must say yes. So the Tanakh still have a major part in and great importance, maybe especially today, and it's so sad that our children are not fluent in Tanakh, It will explain many, many things in Emunah, in our faith, in our connection to Eretz Israel, and that's what will I would like to do also tonight. So, Mark Twain got a nice invitation, I think, from a church group. I'm sure that in Wikipedia you can read more about his journey with his aunt, who was a devoted Christian, to the Holy Land. He got money in condition that he's going to write about his journey. If you want to read the entire book, something that I never did until I got this invitation. And you know what? I wanted to see, like, I always knew about the quote from the book. It was translated by no other than a very famous general in Israel, Rehavam Ze'evi, Hashem Yikom Damo. He was murdered. But he was a great lover of Israel, and he translated this book. In a second, you will understand why, even politically, it's very, very important. It was very, very important. So here, if you want, you have the link to the book itself. There are also beautiful illustrations. But I want to read, with your permission, and you know what? I will be so grateful if someone will just help us to help me, since it's not my mother language, mother tongue. I would appreciate if someone can read this little part that I choose. I think it's chapter 58 from the book. Rabbi Kelman, if you can help me or someone can help me, I will appreciate it so much. Okay.
Okay. Just, you know what? Do you want to share your screen?
Sure.
This is a great read idea. From there. Yeah.
This is a great idea. Give me 1 second, you know, after the vacation.
I can probably share mine, but it's, you share your screen.
Okay. Share even the sound if needed. Here we are. Is it good?
It's coming. Okay, there we go. So you want me to read? Is that the...
you or someone else, I will really appreciate it. You want to hear it in the real English, not in...
Okay, do we have any British people online? Okay. All right, I'll read. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Over it broods the spell of a curse that has withered its fields and fettered its energies. Where Sodom and Gomorrah rear their domes and towers, that solemn sea now floods the plain, in whose bitter waters no living things exist, over whose waveless surface the blistering air hangs motionless and dead, about whose borders nothing grows but weeds and scattering tufts of cane, and that treacherous fruit that promises refreshment to parching lips, but turns to ashes at the touch. Nazareth is forlorn. About that fort of Jordan where the host of Israel entered the promised land with songs of rejoicing, one finds only a squalid camp of fantastic Bedouins of the desert. Jericho is the cursed, lies a moldering ruin. Today, even as Joshua's miracle left it more than 3,000 years ago. Renowned Jerusalem itself, the state least name in history, has lost all its ancient grandeur and has become a pauper village. The riches of Solomon are no longer there to compel the admiration of visiting Oriental queens. The wonderful temple, which was the pride and glory of Israel, is gone. The noted Sea of Galilee, where Roman fleets once rode at anchor, was long ago deserted by the devotees of war and commerce, and its borders are a silent wilderness. Capernaum is a shapeless ruin. Magdala is the home of the beggared Arabs. Palestine is desolate and unlovely, and why should it be otherwise? Can the curse of the deity beautify a land?
I think that the words of Mark Twain just reflect almost like word by word what the Torah said. This is a foreigner who came from Eretz Nochria, and I guess that he expected to see a little bit more than what he really saw. I mean, everything was desolated. He speaks about the fact that for 3 days they were walking from Nazareth to Bethlehem. Again, it was like a trip arranged by the church, and they found only three people on the road. Imagine that, from Nazareth to Bethlehem, you know, at least on the Begin Road today, he could find like hundreds of thousands of people stuck in a pkak, in a traffic jam. But they found only three people. That's why I said politically, it's very, very important. This book was written in 1867. And you have like a first head witness before Herzl came, before the Zionist movement started to spread, like an authentic description of the land of Israel. It was a desolated place full with swamps, deserts, uninhabited places. And you have it from like a very authentic person who just want to tell you how the land looked like. That's why it was very, very important. And actually, this book was quoted in the Fila committee. I'm not going to talk about the political importance of it. Anyway, as I said, the beauty of this description, it's exactly what the Torah just prophesized about, what the Torah description is, that it will be evident. It will be evident from the destruction of the land that it's the wrath of Hashem. It's a special connection or a special, sometimes disconnection between the land and God, exactly as it described in Parashat Nitzavim. Now, as I say, this trip took place in 1867. 600 years before that, another famous traveler, a name that is familiar to all of you, also came to Eretz Israel exactly 600 years before. And I'm talking about Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Ben Nachman, Nachmanides. You know, it's not the time to describe the history of Nachmanides. I know that maybe some people who went on team trips, maybe they even visited the city or the house where the Ramban used to sit until he had to flee for his life from Spain. And a lover of Eretz Israel, by the way, one of the most famous debates between the Ramban with Nun, Nachmanides and Maimonides is, do we have a mitzvah to settle the land of Israel, which the Rambam, for some reason, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, did not count as one of the 613 mitzvot, which upset tremendously the Ramban, who said, no, you must say that this is one of the original 613 mitzvot. So he loved the Eretz Israel with no question, and everyone who read Ramban on the Torah knows how much he indeed loved the land of Israel. So the Ramban arrived to Eretz Israel, and to his dismay and disbelief, he found a very desolated place. I'm sure that he fantasized about finding something, some ruins of the ancient Beit HaMikdash and Jerusalem. He found basically nothing. And he writes a letter to his son, who was behind, I believe, or in Spain or Portugal, cannot remember. And he described again the desolation of the land. Rabbi Kelman, if you can help me here, it will be much appreciated. Many are Israel's forsaken
places. Okay, all right, in English. Many are Israel's forsaken places, and great is the desecration. The more sacred the place, the greater the desecration it has suffered. Jerusalem is the most desolate place of all, and the fruits of the land are pride and adornment. It's
free. Yeah, I just want to give he write it as a poem actually to his son. He wants to describe why the land actually gives something, even something to the non-Jews who are still in the land. And in Hebrew, it's beautiful. It's a kind of a poem. So this is a translation to English. Yes.
Its fruit and produce are plentiful. It is still a land that flows with milk and honey for its dwellers. I have likened you, my mother, to a woman in birth whose child died in her lap. The milk in her breast causes her pain, and so she gives suck to the pups of dogs. And with all this, your lovers despise you, and your enemies find you desolate. And the forsaken places are many in the midst of your fat and large land, for they are not befitting you, nor are you fit for them.
Thank you. Now, you see, actually, the description is quite similar, which is striking. 600 years, the same land and the same description of desolation everywhere as the Torah actually promised. But here, in the difference, I would say, between, you know, Mark Twain, who is a great author and a beautiful description, and the Ramban, who is a giant of Torah. Two people can see exactly the same, but to come to very different conclusions. Because I think it's quite clear from the description of Mark Twain that he does not give much hope to this land upon what he saw. Of course, he had this very cynical attitude in his writing in general, but you can see that there is no hope to the place like this as he sees. But let's see the Ramban. But in order to explain the Ramban, we have to go to the other psukim at the end of Sefer Vayikra, Leviticus, who also contain a rebuke and a set of cursing to the Jewish people. Actually, over there, the Ramban said, "Echad me'em lo ne'edar." There, nothing was missed and not fulfilled in the description of the Torah. So the Torah said, "I will lay your cities waste and make your holy places desolate, and I will not partake of your pleasant fragrances. Vashimoti ani et haaretz, so devastated will I leave the land that your enemies who live there will be astonished. Your land will remain desolate and your cities in ruins." So he explained the word v'shamemu alea oyvechem as a pun. Vashimoti in Hebrew means to desolate. The shamemu is like a person who is mishtomem. He's like so surprised, so astonished. So this pirush of the Ramban is not agreed by everyone. Some say, okay, even the, like Rashi, even the enemies are not going to settle the land, but it more sounds like we have in our rebuke that they are going to be astonished from the scale of the destruction of the land. So the Ramban on this pasuk, he sees something very profound, very, very profound and very, very accurate. And I think that today we can understand it even better. So I need help here in reading, if you don't mind.
Yeah. I'm happy to have another volunteer. Otherwise,
yeah, please. But you did a great job, but we need another volunteer.
That's it. Okay. Does anybody want to volunteer? Or everybody's too quiet? All right, if nobody volunteers, I guess you'll have to listen to me. I'm sorry. Okay. That which God states here, so devastated will I leave the land that your enemies, constitutes a good tiding, proclaiming that during all our exiles, our land will not accept our enemies. This is a great proof and assurance to us, for in the entire inhabited world, one cannot find such a good and large land which was always lived in, and yet is as ruined as it is nowadays. For since the time we have left it, it has not accepted any nation or people, and they all try to settle it, but to no avail.
So the Ramban see this desolation as actually a disguised blessing. Can you imagine? Listen, today we have lots of problems with the Palestinians who declare themselves the indigenous people of Palestine. Now, can you imagine what would happen if the land would be settled? Do you think that the Jews will be ever able to come back to their land? I don't think so. And the Ramban understood it 750 years ago, that this desolation is a temporary state in order to enable the Jews to come back one day to their land with not so many troubles. And listen, even today, they said, we still have many troubles. And unfortunately, if you open the social media, we are the Gazlanim and the Hamsanim, and we took the land and so on and so on. I don't need to repeat it. But say the Ramban, can you imagine what will happen if indeed this piece of real estate, which is sitting between Asia and Africa and Europe, would be settled? Who would give it over? Who would give it over? Can you just imagine, for example, that someone will come from the indigenous people and claim back Manhattan? Okay, they made a mistake. It was a terrible mistake. They sold Manhattan for some, I don't know, less than a dollar. And they regret the whole deal. It's so unfair. And, you know, today, especially in the days of equality, it was a terrible mistake. Give them back Manhattan. Who will even listen to this? Who? Can you imagine what would happen if Eretz Israel would be settled? Says the Ramban, this is the greatest bracha that we have, that indeed the land stayed isolated. V'shamemu aleha oivechem. This is a pele, this is a miracle that something like this happened for more than 2,000 years. The land did not accept anyone else. We have to see the importance of it. Now, just to see what history means, this was written in 1867.
The
Ramban was 1267, and then Mark Twain wrote his diary in 1867, 600 years after. What happened 50 years after Mark Twain wrote his book? I'm talking about the year 1917. The Balfour Declaration, which to me is really something very, very special. If you think about it, it's exactly the Shanim of Yovel, the Jubilee is 50 years. So take the 50 years after this Nochri Me'eretz Nochriya, this foreigner from a remote place comes, 50 years later, after millennia that the land is desolated, the Jews get the permission to go back to their land. What happened 50 years after 1917? Another Yovel. We are in the year 1967. I don't have to tell you what happened. Yerushalayim, Shomron, Yehuda became part of Eretz Yisrael. I'm not talking about the political aspects of it, but let's think about it. 100 years before 1967, a person comes to the land of Israel, and he said, this is a place with no future, zero future. Nothing is here. Exactly to the word of the Torah. 100 years later, after, as I showed you, 600 years, nothing happened. But once Hashem decided that things are going to change, they are changing and very, very fast. And it's interesting that it's a pace of a Yovel. 50 years, Hatzarat Balfour, the declaration of Balfour. Then 50 years, Milchemet Sheshet Hayamim. The Jewish journey took a fast pace towards what we call redemption. And certainly Medinat Israel is Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, but the Tzmichat Geulateinu, the beginning, the sprout of our Geula started even before. The interesting thing that, you know, I just want to end this part is something very interesting that I found in a part of the report that was given to the British committee that came to see how to divide the land. And this came from no other than Sharif Hussein, the guardian of the Islamic holy places in Arabia. And he noticed something very, very interesting. He noticed that the land which is desolated is flourishing under the settlement of the Jewish people. He could see it with his own eyes. If you are not biased, if you see history as it is, as it unfold, you get some respect to the connection between the Jewish people and their Jewish land. So the resources of the country are still virgin soil and will be developed by the Jewish immigrants. That's his words. One of the most amazing things until recent times was that the Palestinian used to leave his country, wandering over the high seas in every direction. His native soil could not retain a hold of him. He talks about the Arab person. So his ancestor had lived on it for 1,000 years. At the same time, we have seen the Jews from foreign countries streaming to Palestine from Russia, Germany, Austria, Spain, America. The cause of Kodesh could not escape those who had a gift of deeper insight. They knew that the country was for its original sons. And here is the Arabic term that he used. For all their differences, a sacred and beloved homeland. This comes from an Arab guy that you know, he just saw what is happening to the land of Israel under the Jewish people who settled the Aliyah Rishona and the Aliyah Shnia. I think it is important, especially when we are on the eve of Shemitah, really to look into this magnificent and unbelievable connection between the Jewish people and their land. And there is a beautiful insight that I found by Rabbi Hirsch, who is talking about the destruction on one hand, and the Shemitah and Jubilee laws on the other hand. So it's interesting to read it. Here is another Rashi that speaks about the disguised blessing in the curse of desolation. And, you know, I just want to make one comment on this Rashi, which I found interesting. Here the Torah said, and I will scatter you among the nations, and I will unsheath the sword after you. Your land will be desolate, and your cities will be laid waste. So Rashi explained here in purple. So Rashi said, this is a harsh thing for Israel. For when the people of a country are exiled to the same place, they see each other and find solace. However, Israel was scattered as if though a winnowing basket. So Rashi see it as a terrible klala that Bnei Israel are not going to be in one place. But you know what? Seeing the Jewish history, I must say that this is also maybe a disguised blessing. Because can you imagine what will happen if all the Jews would be in one place, let's say in Russia or Poland? Sometimes Hashem, with his wisdom, he scattered us all over the globe. So if Chalila, if Yavo Esav el Machaneh Echad Veikau, if Esav is coming to one camp, at least the other one is going to be spared and is going to survive. And that's exactly what happened. When Jews were shecht in Europe, it was our mazel that Hashem scattered us to America or Canada or other places on the globe, that Baruch Hashem over there, they survived. So even in the makot, in the plagues that we get from Hashem, there is some wisdom and means of survival to the Jewish people. However, the Torah says in Leviticus, as only after the Jewish people are going to be in exile, then the land will appease regarding its sabbaticals. During all the days that it remains desolate while you are in the land of your enemies, the land will rest and thus appease its sabbaticals. There is a clear connection here that the Torah makes between exile and not keeping the laws of Shemitah. The punishment for working in Shemitah is to lose this very land where the laws of Shemitah were not kept. And Rashi is making a whole cheshbon that the 70 years that they went to Babel, each one represent a Shemitah, each year of the 70 represent a Shemitah that was not kept. I'm not going to go into this Rashi, you can read it, a very famous Rashi. But here is a beautiful perush of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who draw the connection between exile and the punishment of Hashem and Shemitah. And I just bring it because it's a very interesting junction between the eve of Shemitah in Eretz Israel and the rebukes of Parashat Nitzavim that echo in a way also the rebukes and the curses of Parashat Bechukotai. So if someone can help me here, I would really appreciate it.
Okay, do we have any volunteers? I don't know. I'm not good at getting. Anybody want to volunteer?
We have 58 people. And you know what? That's a problem because in Gematria, it's nach. It's like rest. So we have to work and you guys are.
Yeah. Like Noach, I always say, you know, Noach can't be, okay. Do I hear some? Yeah.
I'll do it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being Nachshon Ben Aminadav, to jump into the water. Thank you.
Nachshon Ben Aminadav.
That's right.
Okay, go.
Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Just as Shemitah and Yovel are supposed to express homage to God in the life of the country and to give light amidst the nations even far away, so too the desolation of the land of Israel expresses homage to God. God warns of it in advance, and he carries out the decree which he ordained long ago. The desolation of the land continues throughout all the hundreds of years of our exile until this very day. The desolation is a large exclamation mark in God's book of history, attesting that the land is God's and that he expects his Torah to be observed in the land.
That's lovely.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I think it's so powerful because you see the land of Israel is supposed to somehow to testify for the greatness of God. Can you imagine when Jews are sitting on their land, they are not working, and nevertheless, the land is blessed, and people can, the entire nation can sit and to learn and to be inspired. I'm sure that everyone in the world who will see it, he will say, "Wow, that's amazing. That's a clear a witness and testimony that indeed there is a special connection between God and land, and between the Jewish people and their land." And unfortunately, if we don't do it in a positive way, then the land is doing exactly the same in desolation. So the greatness of Hashem can be achieved by a bracha, but unfortunately, said Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, can be by klala, because it's so astonishing how it happened. And the only conclusion possible is, well, it's the hand of God here. So it's better to do it in a positive way rather than a negative one. But unfortunately, when we don't do it in a positive way, Hashem forces the land to testify in the most negative way. So this was lesson number one. I always inspired by the fact, because we have the unbelievable schut. You know, always one of my tabs is showing here, Ynet or one Israeli site. And it's always so inspiring. Can you imagine that? Like, I would like to talk to Mark Twain. You know, it's very nice to read his books, but I'm sure that he would be even more astonished to learn about what happened to the Jews in the 150 years after he wrote his book. I don't think that anyone could believe it, and I find it so inspiring for myself, for my students, for every Jew live in these miraculous days. Okay. So this was one. I want to talk about a second idea, and this is how Sefer Dvarim and the Parsha of Nitzavim are actually a closure to the book of Bereshit and the book of Shmot. Because, you know, every great piece of literature, somehow the end has to culminate to bring the beginning to a culmination, to something that will show you the whole purpose of the book. And Sefer Bereshit and Sefer Shmot, I'm sure that you heard it before, are named by Chazal Sefer HaYetzira. The Genesis is Sefer HaYetzira, the creation book. And the second book, the Natziv noticed, is the Sefer Sheni. It's also creation, but a different creation. It's second to the physical creation. It's the creation of a nation. And Sefer Shmot, and in a way, Sefer Vayikra, which actually elaborate over the laws of the Mishkan, are the creation of a nation. Creation of a nation. And it's interesting to see that indeed the same way that Sefer Shmot and Vayikra, which is just elaboration over the Korbanot and how you have to behave when you have a Mishkan in the midst of you, and with the Klalot, the curses of Bechukotai, and Dvarim on the eve of entering the land of Israel, and in the same way with the Brit, to make sure that when Bnei Israel come to Eretz Israel, they know exactly what they have to do, because the temptations, and it indeed happened, are great. So Hashem must make a new contract, a renew contract between the people who enter the land now, the same way as the contract after giving the Torah and the Mishkan and the Chet Ha'Egel and so on. So this is one similarity between the end of Shmot or Shmot Vayikra and Sefer Dvarim. But I want to say a little bit more than that. The Torah says in Pasuk Yutet, in Perek Lamed, in the 30th chapter, this day I call upon the heaven and the earth as witness that I have warned you. I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. You shall choose life so that you and your offspring will live. As you can see here, I made the fonts of Chaim and Mavet and Bacharta Bachaim in bold fonts for a reason. Because these words of Chaim and Mavet and Bacharta Bachaim take us to a very ancient story in the beginning of the Torah. We know that actually this was exactly what Hashem told Adam. Said, listen, you have a choice here. You can eat from all the fruits here, but not from this tree. And once he violated this command, Hashem said, okay, now if he's going to eat from the Etz of Chaim, of life, then he will be like us. Now, this is a very hard parsha, and I'm sure that in a few weeks we all will delve into it. But the idea of Chaim and Mavet is very, very similar to the choices that were given to Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. Now, normally we think in the following way. This is a story about Gan Eden, about the garden of Eden. Once they were exiled, and remember this word is very important, they were exiled from there. The gates are closed. We have the cherubim, we have the kovim standing there, preventing them from going back to the garden of Eden. I think that it will be fair to say that this is not true. The path to the Garden of Eden was a little bit changed. Hashem still wants the human beings to live in a state of the Garden of Eden, which is Le'ovda u'le'shomra. You have responsibilities. You have to work. You have to guard, number one. Most of the needs, the physical needs are going to be provided by the garden itself, the fruits, they providing physical existence. And the main thing that Adam and his wife are going to do is to experience closeness to God. That's the ideal world that they were exiled from. Once Hashem gave the Torah and Eretz Israel, this is a way of a nation to return back to the land of Israel, to the Garden of Eden. The idea of Eretz Israel described in Sefer Dvarim is that once Bnei Israel are keeping and doing the commandments of Hashem, Hashem is going to take care over their Dagan and Tirosh veYitzar. The rain is going to fall. They are going to have plenty of bracha. They are going to get from Hashem, from heaven, everything they need. As long as they are not going to worship other idols, to merge into other cultures. So basically, they are returning to the state of Gan Eden as a nation. And the beautiful thing, if you think about it, is this Kruvim that we spoke about. We find the Kruvim in two places. One is the Kruvim that were preventing Adam and Chava from returning to Gan Eden. But what is the other place where we find the Cherubim, the Kruvim? Where is the other place, the only other place in the Torah that we find them?
Holy of Holies.
Exactly, in the Mishkan, on the Aaron. Namely, when the nation is going to cross the Jordan, and there is a whole chapter describing how the Aaron with the Kruvim is crossing the land, now we, through the Torah, as the nation keeps the laws of God, we are returning to this beautiful land, Zavat Chalav Udvash, where all our needs are going to be sustained by Hashem himself, as long as we don't repeat the mistake of Adam in violating his law and his commandments. So the Torah culminates. She takes the story of Sefer Bereshit and say, okay, and now it's a challenge of a nation who got the Torah. The Torah is in an Aron with Kruvim. That's their way to come in. And think about the pasuk that we say every time that we return the Sefer Torah. Etz chayim hi lamachazikim ba. What is etz chayim? The Torah is saying that there is a way to taste from the tree of life by learning Torah. Over there, the Kruvim are not going to stop you. They are actually going to help you to fulfill this destination. So this is one way where returning to the land, and they were days before crossing the Jordan and coming to the land, is a culmination of what happened in the very first story of Adam and Chava. As the nation, they are returning to Gan Eden. What is Gan Eden? The real Gan Eden? Eretz Yisrael. We don't see it yet, but very soon. The other closure is of Sefer Shmot, of creation of a nation. Just flip it. Chazal were struck with very interesting contradiction. Transformation, I would say, that happened from the beginning of Sefer Shmot, the beginning of the creation of our nation in Egypt, and what happened in the book of Devarim. When Hashem asked Moshe to take the shlichut, to go and to save Bnei Israel and to redeem them, he said to Hashem, Vayomer Moshe el Hashem, Bi Adonai, Lo ish dvarim anochi. I am not a man of words. Neither from yesterday, nor from the day before yesterday, nor from the time you have spoken to your servant, for I am heavy of mouth and heavy of tongue. Moshe self-defined himself, not a person of words. When we start the book of Devarim, the first pasuk, the first verse is, these are the words which Moshe spoke to all Israel on that side of the Jordan, in the desert, and so on and so on. The whole book is a dvarim of Moshe. Wait a second. Didn't you say to Hashem in the beginning that lo ish dvarim anochi, that you cannot speak? And now he gave the longest speech recorded maybe in history. What happened here? So Chazal gave one idea that... after you learn a Torah, the Torah is kind of healing your tongue and you are able to speak a lot. The truth is that the rabbi, I can tell you, apparently once a rabbi have a microphone, he started to talk, even if he saw it before that he can't. So that's maybe explain what happened between the beginning of Moshe Rabbeinu until he became Moshe Rabbeinu, and the rabbi must talk a lot. But this is more like a rabbinic joke. But what happened here? How indeed it happened that a person who is not Ish Dvarim became a person who gives the longest speech in history to his nation? So here the Midrash Tanchuma is actually speaks about it, and he noticed this contradiction between the beginning of the Shlichut of Moshe and his last days where he became Ish Dvarim. I just want to say something which I think is very, very important, and this is my perush to what is lo ish dvarim anochi. You know, when we were in the kindergarten, people say that Moshe Rabbeinu was stuttering. There is a famous midrash. We are not going to go into this one. I think it's very, very simple. Moshe Rabbeinu knew that Hashem tells him to redeem a nation of slaves. He had to inspire them. He had to change their way of thinking. you have to be a very, very special person. Maybe once in a lifetime, you see a person who can inspire other people. You know, not our generation, but you know, there are great people who can inspire by words people. Martin Luther King might be one of them, who himself took example from Moshe Rabbeinu. But to talk to oppressed people, people that over more than 100 years, their whole mindset is a mindset of slaves, Moshe Rabbeinu feels that he's incapable of doing such a thing. He said, "Lo ish dvarim anochi." I don't have the words to inspire these people. I didn't come from their background. Yes, maybe I'm Jewish, but I never suffered their suffering. How can I talk to them? How can you give me a job to inspire a nation of slaves? And I want to say, I'm sure that you heard it before, the whole journey in the desert is a journey that is a journey of nation of slaves. They could not release themselves from this mindset, and therefore they needed 40 years until a new generation adopted a new way of thinking. Obviously, Hashem hoped that, you know, they will step up to the plate and will be able to change their mind, but it's not happening overnight. As David Ben-Gurion once said, "Kal leotzi et ha-yehudim mi-Mitzrayim," it's very easy to take out the Jews from Egypt. It's much harder to take Egypt from the Jews. And this is a major, major issue that is actually shadow all the stories in the end of Shmot Chet Ha'Egel, especially in Sefer Bamidbar. And this generation that Moshe is talking to is a very different generation. It's not a generation of slaves. It's a generation of young people who actually want to have their own land. And everyone who read maybe the history of Zionism and what happened to young people in Europe, once Herzl started to spread the ideas, I think it's quite the same. The people who wanted to put their past behind them. And this was this generation. In one of the beautiful articles of Rav Sacks, he explained that this was the chet of Moshe Rabbeinu between the first time that he hit the rock and the second time when he was supposed to talk to the rock. He said, it's a major difference. To slaves, they understand the language of the stick. That's their life. And when he has to bring water, he takes his stick and hits the rock. That's exactly the language they understand. A new generation, a generation of freedom, you cannot talk this way. You have to educate. It takes more time, but they are capable of understanding things, to be inspired by words, by education. And I think that this idea that maybe we will have the time to read from Rabbi Sacks is exactly what happened between the time that Moshe Rabbeinu described himself, "Lo ish dvarim anochi," I'm not capable of talking too much. I don't have the words to inspire people, because it was a nation of people who could not be inspired, to the beginning of Sefer Dvarim 40 years later, when Moshe Rabbeinu became a person of words. Now he can explain. Now he can talk. Now he can warn not only the great people. How the parsha start, "Michotev Eitzecha," from the logger to the person who draws the water, "Shoev Meimecha." Even these people are capable now of listening, of being educated. And now Moshe Rabbeinu can talk to them, and he talked. So it's not lo ish dvarim for slaves. Yes, sometimes a person is not capable of educating slaves, but he can find the right words for a new generation with a new mindset. And here are the beautiful words of Rabbi Sack that we miss him so much, unfortunately. The remarkable fact about Moshe and the rock is the way he observes precedent. Almost 40 years earlier, in similar circumstances, God had told him to take his staff and strike the rock. Now, too, God told him to take his staff. Evidently, Moshe inferred that he was being told to act this time as he had before, which is what he does. He strikes the rock. What he failed to understand was that that time had changed in one essential detail. He was facing a new generation. The people he confronted the first time were those who had spent much of their lives as slaves in Egypt. Those he now faced were born in freedom in the wilderness. I want to say one more thing. You know, we all have the awe when we read about Kabbalat HaTorah. Kabbalat HaTorah was given with thunders and lightnings and the voice of Hashem that scared the nation. The end of Devarim is very, very different. Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to them, he's signing agreements, he explained what will happen if we don't have it in Netinat HaTorah. And we see it as such a beautiful, magnificent event. But you know who needs all these miracles and the thunder and the lightnings? Unfortunately, the people who are not educated, the people who are looking for something extraordinary in order to understand the fine philosophy behind the commandments. So Hashem has to impress them, so to speak, not through the brain, but through the senses. After 40 years, it's very different. Kabbalat HaTorah, and Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the Torah in his last days, is done in a very, very different way. It's going through education, something that lasts until this very day, because we all know that the first tablets were broken. If the basis to accept the tablets is kind of miracles and thunders, it's not going to last for generations and not even one generation. Education, words, can inspire a nation for years and for generations. So this is the second idea I wanted to speak about. I have another shiur about the idea of Nitzavim and Matzeva. I'm afraid that we are about an hour after I started. I think that sometimes, you know, as a rabbi, I can share with you the following experience. No one complained when I made a Dvar Torah or a shiur 3 minutes less than what was supposed to be. 1 minute late, I get lots of notes from people that it was a little bit too long. So, you know, this is a beautiful opportunity to say to everyone, Shana Tova Umetuka. The Sfardim had a beautiful Slicha before Rosh Hashanah, Tichle Shana Vekilelotea. It's supposed that all the curses will diminish, will end. And unfortunately, we had a few of them last year. Tachel Shana Ubirchotea. The new year should start with all its blessings. And hopefully this year is going to be like blessed and full with Simcha and happiness. We will be able to again host other people and to come to other people and to hug other people. I wish you all a beautiful and sweet year. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Shabbat Shalom and Shana Tova.
Thank you, Rabbi Gemar. Okay, we'll have to leave part three. Maybe you can tell me at Slichus in a few minutes. Summarize part three. Okay, thank you very much. Yashar Koach. A pleasure. 3 more shiurim left in 5781 here. Tomorrow morning, my last year of this series on Perkei Avot at 9:30. And then Sunday, Rabbi Helfgott at 10 o'clock back on Sefer Yonah and Rabbi Liebtag on Sefer Dvarim, continuing his series on Sefer Dvarim. I don't think he said that thing about Elu HaDvarim and Loish Dvarim. I don't think that has come up unless I missed it, but thank you. And then wish everybody, of course, a wonderful year. On Thursday, Tzom Gedalia, Rabbi Shvat will be giving his shiur on Orot HaTshuvah. I'm not sure yet about the parsha next week. It's something that we may move that to Friday. We'll keep you posted. And anyways, okay. Thank you very much, everybody. I think not really a couple, just quick comments in the chat. Okay, Rav Soloveitchik spoke about that Ramban in his famous drasha called the Dido Fake. Hazinu has some of the same language in Breshit. Okay. And Zev, none of these are questions as far as I can tell. Okay, Zev just put a whole quote about Mark Twain and the Jewish people. Okay, thank you very much. And everybody, Laila Tov, and hope to see you soon. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. Bye-bye. Shalom.